So at your tables, you have a paper copy of a concise guide to developing or creating your climate action plan that I've created. That's just a sample. I'm happy to give it to you electronically because it contains a lot of links to resources that should help you in thinking about what your response should be. To get a copy of that, there should also be a sign-up sheet at your table. If you could give me your name and email address, and I'll send it to you. Also, if you could indicate whether you would be interested in forming a Christian Care Ministry team and being part of that effort, please indicate that and call them on the right. So we'll do that, we'll get that logistics taken care of at the start. Now, last week we got pretty deep into a discussion about what kinds of things we can do to have an impact on our own emissions, our emissions within our communities, and then as citizens. We talked about what we could do in those three different roles. And I recall there was a very vigorous conversation at tables about what a manager's response could be. But we didn't really get a chance to harvest what you guys had discussed. So I'm going to just kind of recap last week's conversation by asking those of you who were here to share with me some of the ideas that you discussed at your tables. I'll go to the board here in a second, and I've just written down three columns. I don't know if you can see that from a ways back, but it says facilities or operations. So I'm going to, if you tell me something, I think it fits into something like what Kurt was talking about last week, where you've been doing a lot to reduce the energy use of the buildings here. We'll put it in that column. So that'll include operations of the church as well. And then I have a middle column for things that members, we can do to get members more engaged in reducing their emissions. And then finally, a column of outreach, things we can do to engage with our communities, our elected officials, etc. So I'm going to just ask for volunteers and see what kinds of things you discuss at your table. So let's get started this morning. Come on, I know you guys are not that shy.
We talked about we changed the heat air conditioning system in a sanctuary. Putting the plan together to do that throughout the rest of the
time. Okay, so you've got your heating, ventilation, and cooling system, HVAC, in other parts of the building. I understand you have something like 11 furnaces, I think was what Kurt said. So a big, a lot of them. Others? All right, I know you had, there was so much noise at the tables, I'm sure you have more.
Suggested reducing the size of the garbage cans, making them little, and putting in landfills.
Okay, so
visual.
I'm going to call it refuse labeling.
Okay.
So I know that because of our unique placement being right kind of on the crossroads of I-90 and 405, we actually have a fairly wide draw. So looking at ways to either encourage members, especially coming from farther out, to create carpools or find, you know, alternative routes other than everybody coming from, you know, like Snoqualmie and Redmond and Renton, you know, it's like we have a wide draw, so that's a possibly a lot of emissions every Sunday.
That's a good one. I thought about that. I know there's more. Right here.
About an immigration care team that would remind members monthly of different things that they do to
so I think there's kind of two things there. One was, you know, monthly education, and the other one was creation care management team. Okay.
I think having, and I think this is possibly related to the creation care ministry team, one of the things that we might be able to do is put some funds behind, like, hey, do you have, you know, are you in an apartment and your landlord's not going to upgrade the, you know, the lighting or something there? Having something that helps encourage our membership to either do carbon offsets or do things that make stuff more energy efficient, not just in your own home or the duration that you might be like in an apartment for a year or two, but actually lives longer than that, because then we have a positive impact beyond our own usage boundaries.
Okay. Anybody talk about anything, you know, trying to influence the outside of your community to think about these as concentric circles? There's sort of immediate control of operations of the church, the activities of its members, and then beyond that, your communities and localities. Nobody talked about that. That's interesting. Okay. Did that just not come up at the tables, or is it a topic that people are uncomfortable thinking about?
We ran out of time at my table.
Ran out. That's not surprising. All right. Well, I mean, certainly building operations tends to be the biggest number for most churches, simply because they have large facilities and it takes quite a bit of energy to cool them and create the hot water. There's a little bit less of an impact associated with, you know, the waste you create, but certainly doing a good job of sorting what's going to be recycled and will end up in landfill is really important. I think the other one here that was interesting that you talked about, driving, really, because some churches do have vehicles. Do you have a church vehicle here? Or a,
yeah.
You do. Okay. Well, that didn't come up, but, you know, figuring out when you might convert to electricity to power your vehicles is another thing that is a pretty significant factor. Certainly, you know, once you get a Christian care ministry team together, I think then as they form a plan, a lot of these other things will get talked about more. So we're going to talk today a lot more about the one thing that I brought up at the end of last session that everyone can do that doesn't cost any money and really doesn't take any significant amount of incremental time. Anybody remember what that is?
Talking about it.
Yeah, so today we're just going to spend a session talking about how we talk about global warming with friends, family, acquaintances, and our workplaces, etc. So with that, I'm going to get some help today, too, from Mark Pogel, who's going to help me with a portion of this, because he's got actually relevant expertise on this topic that we're going to incorporate today. So, you know, we talked about last week what other congregations are doing, and I think probably a lot of these things that they're doing came up at your tables. But today, we're going to talk about it, because it turns out recent research has demonstrated that there's a very sort of virtuous cycle that happens when we have more conversations about climate change. And this is some recent research from some people at Yale University who created a big national sample, surveyed people once about their awareness and attitudes towards global warming, what kinds of things they were doing, whether they're having reading about it, talking about it. Then they, 7 months later, came back and administered the survey again, and through that work they were able to, you know, document who was having more conversations or less and how their attitudes differed or were changing as a result. And what they observed in their research was that the practice of just talking about it leads to people to do more learning. They ask questions and they go out and try and get information, and they learn things like, for example, about the scientific consensus about what's happening and why and what the future consequences are. And then in the course of doing that, they become more concerned. And when they become more concerned, then they have a tendency to get more engaged. It might be in small ways, just in their own individual lives, where they may, you know, get engaged in the national discussions or political discussions about this issue. And then when they get more engaged, they tend to have more discussions. So you start this positive feedback loop. But there's one other thing that they learned about this was quite interesting, and they called it reciprocal causality, I think, which just simply meant that this dynamic occurred. Imagine somebody who's already very concerned and somebody less concerned, and we're having a discussion about it. The dynamic worked for both parties. So both parties increased their level of understanding and concern and mobilized more as a result of having that conversation. So this is what I think is probably one of the most least utilized tactics that we have all have at our disposal to help us move towards greater commitment to taking action in this global climate crisis. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, it kind of could be awkward or uncomfortable. You might think it's going to lead to controversy. We tend to shy away from difficult conversations. The one thing that's very helpful to keep in mind is, you know, learning your audience. And this is something that I've learned recently that I found is surprising to many people, which is we actually share a lot more of a common sense about what we need to do to address the global warming crisis than many people realize. So I'm going to share with you some information from the Yale Climate Communications Project, which is the place that has the longest running and most rigorous sample of awareness and attitudes over time amongst Americans about this topic. And as they've done their surveying, they've come up with a taxonomy or a categorization, and so they have created six segments in our population and track how those change over time. So I'm just going to describe those for you for a moment. So you can think about these across the spectrum, where, you know, at one end there's the greatest level of understanding and belief this is a severe and urgent problem that's happening right now, as a result, the greatest level of concern and highest motivation. And at the other end is kind of the opposite end of it. But the distinct segments that they've identified are, one, alarm. People who have fully reviewed and completely appreciated the fact that global warming is going to be a problem for everyone in the future, and it already is affecting hundreds of millions of people around the world. As a result, they've become extremely concerned and they've gotten mobilized in some way. The concern segment is also generally understands the problem, but they have a tendency to think that it's largely going to affect other nations or, you know, people in the future, so it's not as pressing. As a result, they may still have a great deal of concern about the future as it relates to the global warming phenomenon, but they're not really motivated to get engaged in the present. The cautious group is maybe unsure. You know, they don't really know, they've heard there's controversy, and as a result, they're just sort of not forming a strong opinion. The disengaged group is not as aware, but not trying to understand, not really seeking any information, and as a result, they're just not focused on it at all. The last category is doubtful and disputed. Are have an opinion about it, and they think either, well, you know, climate has always changed. It's always changing. This is just a normal course of events, and you know, it's not really due to humans. You know, and then the dismissive folks actually think, well, this is a hoax, or you know, there's a conspiracy of scientists or others that are trying to fool us that this is really happening. So that's sort of the extreme end. And you may recall that for those of you who filled out a survey at the beginning, I think I got almost 40 of them back, there were four short questions that you completed. And that's the short form of what they can do to create the segmentation. You won't be surprised to learn that in this group, 87% are in the alarm category. And to a person, everybody is either alarmed or concerned. And I think, too, the thing that this group realizes, and maybe it's, you know, part of your in your capacity as a Christian, you think more about your generational impacts. Everyone's very worried about what it's going to do to people in the future. So you're quite a bit different than America as a whole, but you should also feel reassured that this group is becoming larger and larger. The alarm group has become the largest group over the past 5 years, and it's growing the fastest. And I think, you know, you probably also noticed that this year, for the first time in the primaries for the Democratic presidential candidates, are talking about it a lot. And they all formed plans, and it was almost absent from the national conversation during the previous election cycle. So it's definitely statistically true that there's a whole lot more discussion going on about this, and that it's now become right up with health care for people who are Democrats. It's become their number two issue. And for Republicans who are under the age of 40, it's a very important issue too. So regardless of which party you're in, it's becoming better understood and, you know, greater level of concern over time. So I think you might find that more people, let me just ask a question. How many people have had interactions with people they think are more at this end of the scale? You know? Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Even though we live in a blue bubble, so to speak, I think almost all of us have had interactions with or talked to people or know people that are more in that category. So you probably have some uncomfortable discussions maybe about it with people if they're in your family, for example. But we'll help with that dynamic in what we're going to do today. The other thing I want to mention is that regardless of what you think about this the problem of global warming, there is a lot of agreement across the aisles about the things we should do. And again, this is from the same data set, but as part of that ongoing survey, Yale Climate Communications has observed that the majority of voters in both parties are in favor of some of the most important solutions that we have at our disposal right now to address this crisis, including an agree on having tax rebates on things like efficient cars or solar panels, putting generating more clean energy on public land, regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant, and participating in the Paris Climate Accords. And finally, you know, putting in place a revenue-neutral tax, you know, one that gives the proceeds back to the citizens on fossil fuels use. So all of those share a opinion that those would be good policies to pursue. And even, you know, and we also think that the U.S. should do more regardless of what other countries do. So there's a lot more common ground than I think we may have thought about this issue. So I say all that just to hopefully get people to a point where they have a greater a level of comfort in talking about this with other people. But what I'd like to do now is kind of switch gears and ask Mark to join me and talk about some of the techniques and, you know, sort of core principles that can help us with these conversations that come out of the psychology profession. Mark, did you want to use this?
Can you hear me, or would it be better for me to use that? You can hear me okay? Let's just go with this. Raise your hand if at some point my voice drops, because I spend a lot of time in small spaces where I kind of keep my voice low, because many of the people I work with as a counselor are used to having people yell at them, and I don't want to be one of those people. So, for those of you who don't know me, I'm a member of the congregation here. I'm also a counselor on the staff at the American Center of Jesus Sound with an office here, so I'm here a couple days a week. So before I get into this, how to talk about global warming, I do want to say just a word of what makes it difficult for us to talk about global warming sometimes. And there's at least a couple reasons from my own self-observation as well as talking with other people. First of all, some of us come here with a sense of both guilt or shame that we have not done enough, we've not listened enough, we've not been engaged enough, and there's some sort of fear, underlying fear of exposure that might lead us to disengagement. Or avoiding talking about it at all. It's sort of this notion, if I can't do it well, I won't do it at all. And some of us have a more difficult time resting easy in doing something that will be helpful. So what I'd like to say to that without a large conversation is it seems like we have plenty of consolation and encouragement from our faith. We all fall short, as Paul says, of the glory of God. But we are justified by grace as a gift, so we can rest in that, as well as the knowledge that the widows might mean something, or the loaves and fishes mean something when it's blessed, and who knows what God can do with that, the impact our little, what feels like little, may have. The second reason, I think, is that many of us would like to avoid conflict as much as we can. And there's anticipation of differences being dangerous and maybe resulting in an argument that is just going to disrupt relationships. So I think that's the second reason that some of us may be familiar with of why we would avoid talking with other people. So what I'd like to suggest this morning is talk about a little bit about a way to talk about other people that was developed in the psychology profession around 30 years ago, that has been picked up by other vocations, among them business and medicine, and now climate activists, as a way to engage other people in this conversation. It came out of psychologists' work with clients who they understood came to therapy really wanting to make a change in their lives, had a goal, and as they started moving towards that goal, became indecisive or ambivalent, or weren't quite motivated in order to get to that goal. They kept asking themselves, well, what's going on here? Because their first movement with these folks was to, well, what they needed, just more reasons and more facts, and good persuasion, and so they just did that. They presented, these are reasons why it would be good for you to make this change, or use their best kind of persuasive techniques, whether that be reasoning, or whether it be demanding, or whether it be looking at the future and how good it would be. And what they saw in many of these clients was that it didn't move them forward. It didn't foster more motivation. So they began to ask themselves, what's going on here? And they determined that it was something that they grew to call the backfire effect. And that is, in essence, this. The more you push someone to do something, what happens? The more they push back. You know, psychologists are really smart people. Finally, they get to this place of common knowledge that we all know. So the more you push, the more you push, get pushback. So that's the first thing. So then they thought, well, if that doesn't work, what might work? And so then they came up with what some of us also might realize is fairly common knowledge, is that people are most motivated to do something by their own reasons for doing it rather than somebody else's reasons for doing it. And so then the shift was, rather than to try to convince them to do something, the shift was to try to elicit their reasons why doing this could be important for their lives. And it was out of that, then that this whole way of doing therapy developed that came to be called motivational interviewing. There's a great book on it if you'd like to read about it by William Miller and Stephen Gronick called Motivational Interviewing. I think it's in the second edition now. So more recently, climate change activists have used this method to help people to engage in conversation about global warming. And there are two parts to this. One part is the principles, and the other part is the skills. Now, as pragmatic Americans, many of us will just want to go to the skills. Let's just learn the skills, use the skills, and that's all we need. But I'd like to suggest that the principles are really foundational and important, because that's the spirit of it. And I think that really that's the most difficult part of this process, because the first principle is that we enter into partnership with people. This is about entering into a kind of a collaboration, seeing them as members of the team, rather than seeing them as adversaries or problems, obstacles. This is a very different posture to take. The next two things, acceptance and compassion, are really dispositions we would have. This is about acceptance, unconditional, without conditions, of accepting people, approaching people as they are, who they are, where they are. Now, we should know something about this, drawing on resources from our Christian faith. And this is one place in which we can bring that to the fore. Compassion really has a lot to do with understanding. And part of the work here is sort of widening the lens, rather than focusing on that, just that difference that we have, of gaining some understanding of who they are as a person. What matters to them? What are their life circumstances? To try to get inside of them to understand who they are and how they go about doing things from the inside, from their point of view. And within that, then the fourth thing, evocation, and that is now knowing more about who they are, then we, instead of pouring information into them that we hope will persuade them, what we're doing with evocation is we've now are positioned to elicit a response grounded in what they have said, now what we know about them and what matters to them. We're in position to make a connection. And so climate, this is really important, because it begins with this posture that these are not adversaries. We want to enter into a posture of collaboration. Core skills. Then these are the actual skills that we can use then in this process. The big one is open-ended questions. Most of us are used to closed questions. Do you believe in climate change? Yes or no? These are all the yes or no questions. Conversation enders. Over against question like, what have you heard about climate change? What do you think about climate change? How does climate change impact you? These are open questions that are inviting conversation, and through that you're going to learn more about who these people are, how they think, what matters to them. Affirmations along the way. I would suggest there's always something to affirm about everyone. Always something to affirm about everyone. If we can't do that, we just don't know enough about them yet. We might affirm their values, their efforts, their intentions, their strengths, their perseverance, and their circumstances. There's always something to affirm. And when those things come up in these conversations, it is important to do that. Why? Because it will feel less adversarial to them, that they feel like we're coming alongside of them in the conversation. Affirmations, reflective listening is probably the heart of this. This is about showing that we understand them, showing understanding. It's really, on the one hand, paraphrasing, saying what they have said in a little bit different words. The other part of that might be to at least suggest what's underneath that, what's implied in what they're saying. That kind of moves the, as it were, moves the conversation forward, extends the paragraph, as it were, and ask them, is that right? Am I picking up what you're saying? Am I understanding what you're trying to communicate. And then the summarizing would be the last course, you know. After all is said and done, you're going to know something about this person. You're going to have a kind of idea about what matters. And so then you're, it's a kind of a global summary. So there's A, there's B, there's C, and then you get to the ask. You're summarizing, and this moves you. You're in position now to ask something that's small, and then they can say yes to it. And that's really, really, really important. The idea is to get a foothold into the door for further conversation. It's not about asking something that's going to be too great where they're going to say, oh, I don't think so, or let me think about that, or just no. It's really about asking for something that they can say yes to, and that then you can come back to for further conversation. So that's the process, and that's just about doing this over and over again. I think that's so,
right?
Yes, but you. So, yes, so Jeff and I are going to do a role play of how this might look in a conversation. This is a something that Jeff has written, and I'll do my best to play my role.
And this is, there's an assignment for you in this. You have to do work here.
No.
Your job is, as we do this little role play, to try to identify where these principles or core skills are being demonstrated. And we're just going to make some notes about those on the board. So
we're supposed to shout it out when we see it.
Well, that's a good question. I think you might want to, as soon as you hear something, just like put your hand up. And but also just make a note to yourself, because I do want to like try to jot some of them down. Because Mark mentioned that there might be things in here that we didn't notice that you would pick up on that would be helpful in just getting us to think a little bit more about and illustrate some of these principles and skills. So with that in mind, let me just a little scenario here, and you'll recognize the genesis of this. So these are two friends, they're old friends who live far apart, they don't talk very often. One of them recently had a birthday. And the other friend gave a gift on their behalf to Citizens Climate Lobby for the birthday. All right, and the gift giver is one who's more in that alarm category, and the recipient is one who's more in the concern category. But they don't really know that about each other because they don't talk very often. I will start out here. Hi, Mark. Happy birthday.
Well, thanks for remembering. And thanks for the card and gift. Although these days I try to pretend birthdays aren't happening.
Yeah, me too. I wasn't sure how that gift would be received because I don't know if you're familiar with the Citizens Climate Lobby. And because I haven't spoken with you in a while, I really don't know what you think about global warming. Would you be willing to share your thoughts on that with me?
I guess so. I mean, I understand that global warming is happening, and it's going to be bad, but I mostly try not to think about it. I just want to get my kids through college and get to retirement. It seems like a far-off problem that probably won't affect me very much. Although the smoke fires this summer really was bad for a few days.
Well, how does it make you feel when you think about how global warming will affect your kids?
Well, frankly, it's depressing. My kids, they're pretty angry about it. They think that we adults have really made a mess of things. My daughter tells me she's even having discussions with friends about not having children because she doesn't want to bring them up into a world filled with ecological collapse.
Yeah, that must be difficult for you to hear. My kids feel the same way. It makes me sad. I want to have grandkids. What do you think you can do that will have an impact on global warming?
Well, I understand that we need to use more clean energy than fossil fuels. but I don't feel like I have much influence over that. We're stuck with our utility. I'm not going to sell my house, and it would be very expensive to put solar panels on it. And we don't have many miles on our SUV, even though it doesn't get good gas mileage. And I just don't want to replace it.
Yeah, it sounds to me like you think the only things you can do require a lot of money. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Actually, there are things you can do that don't take much time or money and are really important.
Like what?
Well, to start, it's very important to talk about it with friends, family, colleagues, acquaintances, just like we're doing now. You can also contact your elected officials and ask them to support solutions to global warming. I find it takes me less than 10 minutes, you know, to make 3 phone calls to my representatives in Congress. I usually have a short, polite conversation with a staff person who appreciates my call and tells me they'll promise to pass my concern on to the congressperson.
Well, that doesn't sound too hard, but does it really make a difference?
Well, I was surprised to learn that when a member of Congress's office gets 5 phone calls on a topic during a day, it gets their attention. And if they get 25, that feels to them like a tsunami of public opinion. Just think how much impact it could have if we all got organized and worked together. The group I made the donation to for you helps me do that by providing you some tools to contact Congress and some education about what to say.
Well, I suppose it might make me feel better about the future, too, if I could do something tangible now.
Yeah, I agree about that. I found that it helps me be productive and engaged rather than just simply anxious about global warming. So I'm happy to share specific suggestions with you if that's helpful to you.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Okay, well, I heard today you're concerned about global warming, but I'm not really sure what you can do. It doesn't take a lot of time or money. So what I'll do, I'll send you an email with some suggestions and links to resources that will give you more afterwards.
Good. Thanks.
So, I'll give you a hand up, but I'm assuming you probably picked up on it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Who wants to share? Okay.
We did a really good job of the open-ended question part of the affirming.
Okay, so there were some open-ended questions. What do you think you can do? How does it make you feel? How's it affecting your kids?
Right. And he came around to acceptance. Eventually.
He did here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what were some open-ended questions? You caught those. Did you catch any examples of affirmations?
Yeah, you agreed with them about worrying the kids and not wanting kids wanting grandkids and or you know.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one form that this can take, which is just simply to say, yeah, I understand how you feel. There's another form that this takes that I've been trained on in some of the work I've been doing with Citizens Climate Lobby, which is actually when you go in and meet with a congressperson, the first thing you do is called appreciation, thanking them. We actually cite some things that they're doing that we want to thank them for. So, I mean, that's a little more, takes a little more preparation and all that, but that's another form that can take. What about reflected listening?
You mentioned something of, you recognized that money was a concern, and you voiced that to him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, again, I kind of over-illustrated here, but I even said, did I get that right?
Right.
You know, so that was the part where I was paraphrasing, as you put it a moment ago, but then also just confirming that I just did that. And, you know, we may think that it's not really necessary or it's a little artificial, but I've actually witnessed a number of interactions, again, in this sort of different setting, where when you do that, you get another level of response. Because they tell you a little bit up front, and then when they hear that you're actually not just there to yell at them, I'm using the interaction with elected officials scenario, then they open up a little bit more, and they tell you a little bit more. So that's one of the things that's been valuable to me about this whole process. Because, I mean, I was trained to be pour information into people. This is my default mode is the more information they get, of course, that'll change their minds and they'll immediately start to be mobilized and active. That's not always very useful. Often counterproductive. So, summaries. This is a little more business-like. It's kind of like, you know, next steps from a meeting. You know, you're not going to leave here without having figured out who's going to do what next. But we haven't really talked a lot. We talked a little bit, maybe, about the partnership of equals. Were there places where you saw some of that happening?
On the last one, the summaries, you didn't start throwing detailed suggestions back, except for one thing off about calling your congressman. But you said, I'll send you an email about stuff you can do, not, okay, here's six things, and which one do you assign to do, and you just put them on the spot to do any of them.
Yeah.
The first question, though, almost sounded like, well, this could be a closed ender, because you were like, basically, you could just said no. Like, the first question on your list?
Yeah, I could.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, I don't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess
That's true.
How do you get around that? I mean, what's the worst way to open it back up?
Why not?
Well, I mean, why not? No, I think that is a great question. Can you tell me more about that, or why wouldn't you want to talk about that? I think that can be a fair question. And then if they say, you know, that they really close the door, then just be respectful of that.
I think
it can be a follow-up question.
Yeah, that's the thing is to, this is more about creating and furthering a relationship. So the expectation is that you're going to have interactions over time, mm-hmm. and that you want those interactions to move someone up a ladder of support, as we talk about it with the training we've gotten, which is spinal body. And so sometimes you just have to say, well, we didn't get very far today. And you just move on, change gears. You know, you don't want to make it confrontational or adversarial. So you don't always get a chance to talk about what you want to talk about. So that was kind of a segue, I think, to what we wanted to do next for a few minutes, which is to have you at your tables talk and maybe think about, since you mentioned that you had some scenarios in mind, people that you might have interaction with, whether in the concern group or the just not engaged or even at the dismissive or doubtful part of it. Think about some of those people you might interact with and come up with some open-ended questions. And just jot some of them down. And then for those of you who are willing, daring, try using one of those open-ended conversations in a conversation, just or open-ended questions in a conversation, just like we did a moment ago. Okay, so
good. Thank you. I have to be mindful of the clock. I think you're all having so much fun doing that. Were there any insights that you want to share that came out of your discussions in your group? Anything that comes up?
Well, either the oldest people at our table are the most progressive people as far as actually putting this stuff to work in their world.
Yeah, you can't make any assumptions, by the way, about, you know, related to age or ethnicity or gender or anything on it. We span the spectrum. And did you have anything to share with your group?
Of course, we're all from the U.S. here, so we don't talk about things.
Avoiding confrontation.
You gotta do it. But we all felt like we wanted to do something, had no opening. And of course, she came up with a brilliant talk about the weather, which we all feel so comfortable talking about, and how to lead into it. And that was really helpful to kind of think of how you get into that.
So the weather seems like really obvious, right? Almost so obvious that it seems trite, but the fact that we talk about weather all the time, and more and more the pattern of weather over time is the changes are becoming really clear. I mean, for example, where I grew up in Alaska as a youth, at the time I lived in Alaska, the average temperature in Barrow, it's one of the northernmost communities, in February it was 10 degrees less than it is now. Average temperature. This spring in March, they had temperatures for a week or so that were 30 degrees above the normal that time of year. So, I mean, some of the changes are just still found are obvious.
So, I had a recent conversation, I was telling myself last week with a colleague who's known on the Republican side run for office using his last election cycle, right? And we've got this conversation briefly about the natural gas plant in Tacoma, reasons for it, and using ships using, you know, bunker fuel, and but then he was also talking about, okay, that should be a good thing because some of the using all electricity is connected to, you know, using fossil fuels that work somewhere else. So I wasn't really sure, you know, how to change it. Okay, what's your rationale here? Is it more like one of the big utilities gone, or it was really for climate change or what? I'm trying to open that conversation. What's your motivations here? Because obviously it is where he is, you need to be a potential huge advocate on that. You know, deep in that environment. But I'm not trying to turn it to, you know, actually have a conversation about climate change, which is just, you know.
So did you have some open-ended questions?
It was a very short conversation. We actually had work to do with these in my office. I thought you lost your weapon, buddy. He's a very well spoken, respected guy, and I'm like, okay, and he had some points. I'm thinking, like, I'm okay, maybe he could be full on in the concern with all about the climate change thing, where he is, or it could have been the fact that, no, he's trying to use the arguments for what he wants to do. And I was going to ask you, okay, is that a good thing or a bad thing for what they're trying to do to Tacoma? But even then, how do you, you know, given.
Well, today I'm just going to refer back to some of these lessons.
Yes, right.
And I simply say,
we'll talk about that later.
But yeah, look for a chance to have a conversation with them again.
Right.
Where you have hit, you maybe got an open-ended question or two queued up as a starter. I mean, that was kind of the point of this exercise. It's helpful to us to have a couple of these back pocket and be able to pull them out and use them. I recently did this with my daughter, who doesn't like to talk very much. She's an electrical engineering service student at the U. And I asked her, this was really non-confrontational because I was asking her, they're tired of me talking about it, obviously. And I asked her, well, what do students on campus think about this? So sometimes I'm just going to bring that one up because that's a little, even a little more indirect. And sometimes people will then use that as a way that it will transition to what you're talking about. Well, you know, our purpose today was just to give you a sense for some tools that you can use to kind of have more conversations and about the importance of having those conversations. I'm going to be mindful of time. There's two brief things I wanted to talk about before we wrap up. And the first is that there's a really strong connection between global warming and social justice. And, you know, I know that we as Christians have a calling to take care of and protect the poor and vulnerable. And, you know, most churches are super focused on that. I was sitting outside for a moment looking at the board and realizing we've got things going all over the place that are helping marginalized communities and people in this community who may be marginalized. But I don't think most churches have really made the connection between that social justice work and global warming. I'm going to assert right now that I think global warming is the greatest challenge to social justice facing humanity. And I'll just share briefly, we did this in the first last time, but remember that of 7 billion-ish people in the world, 4 billion of them live on less than $8 a day. And life for them is very different than it is for us. We live on the median income per person in Bellevue is $187 a day. And we have savings accounts and retirement plans and insurance policies on our house, on our car, those things. In contrast, most people in the world either get around on foot, they might have a bicycle, they may or may not choose. They have to fetch their water from a well or from natural sources, which may not always be clean. They use a gas stove maybe to cook their food or just an open fire with whatever fuel is around them. If they're lucky, they can share a mattress to sleep on at night, otherwise they just sleep on the dirt floor. And they haven't had a lot of schooling, maybe they've had some grade school or maybe no school at all. So that's 4 billion.
And you know, we're off the edge of that chart somewhere. So when you think about major catastrophes, you know, of extreme fires or floods or storms or water shortages that come from a lack of snowfall, these are the things that they don't have the capacity to endure. I mean, they don't have any, they can't be resilient in the face of these kinds of challenges because they just don't have the resources. So, you know, that's going to become more and more of a challenge going forward. And I think, you know, we as Christians need to think about the connection between that and social justice work. I want to end by simply, you know, issuing a call to action. I recently read a book called The Uninhabitable Earth by David Wallace Wells. And that's a book in which he just delivers some straight talk based on our current scientific understanding of what things will be like in a world of several degrees of warming or more centigrade in the future. And I have to say, it was painful to read about that and all the conversations with scientists about what the, you know, what things would be like. But I think it's really important for us to do that, to understand what we need to do now and how important it is for us to be acting now. Because the fact is that the decisions we're making right now are going to have a profound effect on the level of global warming going forward. So we need to be doing things right now because we don't have a lot of time. And I think the kinds of disruption that we're going to see and the impact of it is starting to become more apparent to us. I mean, look at what's happened in Australia recently. Mm-hmm. Over the course of the summer, the area that burned was more than half, 60% of the land of the state of Washington. Mm-hmm. So you think, just kind of draw a line somewhere over east of the mountains, everything to the west burned, and burned severely. Mm-hmm. And the current estimates are that as many as a billion creatures perished in those fires. And because it's Australia, there are species that are now extinct because they only existed there. Wow. And not only are their populations decimated, but their habitats decimated. So that impact was just really profound. The thousands of homes were burned, you know, even in a lightly populated area, which is where most of this took place. The city of Sydney, which is, you know, not wasn't real close to most of the fire, it was mostly in New South Wales, I think. City of Sydney had 81 days of hazardous air quality, and that was more than what had been experienced in the 10 previous years. So, you know, that was just 60% of the entire population of the country was affected. So the country will never be the same. So, you know, that's kind of really shocking and awful, but the fact is we do have, thinking back to the first session, which I know not everybody was present for, but we did a review of some of the major solutions that we have available right now that will help us dramatically reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the fact is that those solutions, even the ones we only have now and are more coming, enable us to make this transition achievably and affordably to a decarbonized economy that could be thriving in the future. But the fact is that today, globally, our greenhouse gas emissions continue to increase. And so we are, in fact, right now choosing severe levels of global warming in the future. And so we need to be making a major course correction now in order to avert the worst of the possible damage that could occur in the future. So there's a lot we can do right now, individually, as a community. We talked about some of those things, and today, you know, the emphasis was just on talking about the problem and the solutions. We have a lot of them that we can put to work in our households. We talked about being carbon neutral, which is a process. It's something you can do right now, which will actually, to address Mark's comment earlier, maybe help a little bit with the guilt. So you can go carbon neutral right now. You can commit to a life in which you regularly measure your impact, or just estimate it. It doesn't have to be a big task. Do what you can to reduce it, and then offset what you can't reduce.
and just make that part of your standard operating procedure in your house, your household every year. And then I think probably the most important thing we need to do is just demand change. We need to be voting for candidates that are committed to solutions. We need to be talking to our existing elected officials. You can go down any day to the city council meeting and talk for a few minutes. It's obviously more powerful if you do that with a group than if you do it individually, but you always have that access, and it's not that hard to reach it. So, you know, a lot of people, I think, are probably a little overwhelmed by all this and feel like, my actions just don't matter all that much. But I challenge that assumption. And I have case number one is pictured on the right there. Does anybody recognize who that is?
Yeah.
Greta Thunberg. All right, so Greta Thunberg was just another depressed, introverted, anxious 15-year-old in the fall of 2018 when she decided that she couldn't take it anymore and the adults weren't doing anything about the climate crisis. So she took her sign to the steps of the Swedish parliament and sat there with it on a Friday, and she came back on subsequent Friday. And eventually people started to join her. Next thing you know, she's addressing the Swedish parliament, she's addressing Davos and giving them a piece of her mind on behalf of the whole generation. And she's sparked a major, global student movement. At a year after she started doing that, in September this past year, there were something about 5 million people around the globe who struck against climate in action. So that's, and now she's Time's Person of the Year, right? So tremendous impact, one person just making a commitment to change.
I mentor a seventh grade boy once a week, and I have for several years. And last Thursday, we were talking about a lot of different things, and I said, what's the most important thing that kids worry about right off the bat? Climate change.
Clearly, young people understand it. It makes them, in some cases, angry and depressed. There are all these emotions about it because it's something they can't really control right now. But, I think there is a lot we can do if that much happen. Just imagine if all the faith communities in this region got together and decided we're going to all be carbon neutral and we're going to start interacting as communities with outside of our churches to try and bring about that kind of change. I think there's a lot we can accomplish. So, just doing more, and there's a guide on the table that's just a sample. I'll send it to you electronically if you want to give me your name and email address, and then if you would have interest in joining the Gracing Care Ministry team, I am happy to counsel, advise about how you could go about, setting up a carbon emissions reduction plan for the congregation, and you've got a lot of creative ideas about what you can do, and I think that community, that team could help surface those and make them part of your mission, your ministry here at St. Andrew. So thank you very much for coming.